You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
Tell the people that we're living in these times.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. You can work all your life and expect to get back some benefit for your years of toil. If you are a teacher in California and in 13 other states in the nation, you may not get back all that you expect from Social Security. With us today are David Walrath, a legislative advocate for the Retired Teachers Association in California, and Bill Lambert, a former government relations officer for United Teachers Association. We'll talk about two bills dealing with two major issues affecting Social Security benefits: the government pension offset penalties and the windfall elimination provision. While David Walrath and Bill Lambert are from California and have both been teachers, the issue affects firefighters, police officers, postal workers, and even some military personnel in, as I mentioned, about 14 states in total. We'll learn which states those are and more about the bills H.R. 82 and S. 206. We'll also get a brief update from lawyer and policy analyst Andrew Lichterman on the next step toward a deal between the United States and India on India's nuclear capability. Let's start with David Walrath, and I asked David, a legislative analyst for the Retired Teachers Association in California, to describe the bills.
The bills are exactly the same. They are titled the Social Security Fairness Act. One is in the House of Representatives, the other is introduced in the United States Senate. They both repeal the offset penalties that are part of Social Security. The two offset penalties, the first is referred to as government pension offset, and the second is referred to as windfall elimination provision. Both act to reduce earned Social Security benefits. To go to the history of how they came about and how they operate, the government pension offset was first passed in 1977, but did not become operative until about 1982. That penalty reduces the Social Security that was earned by individuals for spousal provisions. Let me give an example. Let's say somebody worked 30 years in private industry, earned Social Security, and was married. Under Social Security, the married spouse is eligible to receive a spousal benefit. And the death benefit from the Social Security earner upon the death of the earner. The government pension offset reduces that spousal benefit, $2 for every $3 earned by a government pension. Those types of reductions are not made if it's a private earned pension, only if it is for certain government pensions. And California educators are affected by the government pension provision.
And what is the logic behind that?
The logic behind it was a twofold logic. The first piece was dealing with, they were trying to reduce Social Security payments. Social Security has a ongoing long-term funding problem. So Congress was looking at how they could reduce Social Security outlays without reducing income. So this was a way of addressing that, and also trying to look at how a two Social Security earner would be treated. And there is a offset for a two Social Security earner as well. However, the offset for the two Social Security earner is not as great as the government pension offset, particularly when it comes to survivor benefits. So they were trying to create something that they thought was going to be equitable between the two, be it two Social Security earners or somebody with a government pension. they didn't get it right. They made the government pension offset much more severe. And so that is why over time, as people have become more and more affected by this, it has become more and more obvious that what Congress was attempting to do, they didn't succeed. They went, I won't say overboard, but it was a much more severe penalty than what would have otherwise been an equitable attempt to adjust between the two.
So let me ask you this. While they were working this out, it must have been apparent to those people that work with numbers that this was going to become inequitable over time.
Actually, it didn't. My expectation is that they didn't run enough different scenarios.
Uh-huh.
And so the outcome was not anticipated. Government frequently has unintended consequences with their actions. This is one of those unintended consequences as to the severity of the offset.
And so it's affecting primarily in California the teachers.
Teachers, some county employees, a lot of police and fire.
I see.
So it's not simply educators.
Uh-huh.
Within the state of California right now, we believe there are approximately 700,000, 800,000 public employees who are or will be affected by this.
And across the country, since this is also a Senate bill, who are the affected parties?
Every state has some people who are affected.
So.
Different states have different people. There are 14 states where educators are affected. There are a number of states where county or municipal employees are affected. There are a number of states where just police or fire are affected.
I see.
It is not consistent, as you say, state by state by state. Some states have more than 80% of their public employees affected. Other states have only about 5%.
Sounds as if it's only once you go onto Social Security that you really begin to notice this.
Primarily has been when people went in to file for earned Social Security benefits, they were told, sorry, you are not going to be receiving that benefit. There was no outreach from Social Security. Do you remember the annual Social Security benefit publication that people receive every year?
Uh-huh.
Quarters, how much earnings?
Exactly, yeah.
Up until around 3 or 4 years ago, that information piece did not reference these two offset penalties.
I see.
And so people were receiving that year after year after year and expecting that that document was an accurate reflection of what they'd be receiving.
Oh, that's a really important point.
Only recently has Social Security been including in that document, there are these two penalties that might affect you. Please check with your Social Security office.
So people have been planning on one amount when they're retired and actually going to be getting less than that.
Correct. And on the government pension offset, before we get to the so-called windfall elimination provision, on the government pension offset, it is frequently the case where the male spouse has been the long-term Social Security earner, and the female spouse was the teacher. And the amount of earned retirement benefit from education is based upon years of service and final compensation. Most women have less years of service because of being caregivers, being mothers, the other types of activities that are more related to women. Consequently, they don't earn as much of a retirement out of education as would somebody who worked 35 continuous years.
Mm-hmm.
But even with a 15-year career, it is probable that that small benefit will be more than enough to totally wipe out the death benefit, survivor benefit, from the spouse.
Hmm.
So if when the spouse, the Social Security earning spouse dies, the widow not only goes through the whole emotional trauma of having lost a spouse, there is a major financial hit at the exact same time.
Hmm.
That was not truly anticipated as an outcome of the government pension offset.
Hmm.
On the windfall elimination provision, that was done, I believe, in 1982, 83, becoming operative in 1986. This is not partisan, by the way. Government pension offset was done under, I believe, President Carter. Windfall elimination provision, I believe, was done under President Reagan. Both were passed by bipartisan majorities in Congress. So these are not partisan issues. The windfall elimination provision is slightly different. When the federal government restructured Social Security, increased contribution rates, did a variety of other actions in leading up to 1986, they adopted a lifetime earnings concept. And so people who had, particularly teachers in California, who had worked summers or worked evening jobs in order to earn the Social Security needed for Medicare eligibility may have 60, 70 quarters. When Congress adopted the windfall elimination provision and it was signed into law, they started looking at a lifetime earning, 135 quarters, about 35 years, whatever that converts to in quarters. So if you had worked evenings, summers, had, you know, 60 quarters or so, the federal government looked at that and said, well, you didn't work our whole lifetime number. Therefore, we will reduce your earned Social Security because you didn't earn enough quarters. It's very late in the game to tell that to somebody.
Exactly. Exactly.
Because they don't have enough time to earn.
Yeah.
So that penalty came in and reduces by slightly more than $300 a month, growing every year, the earned Social Security. There are people who would otherwise have $400 or $500 a month of earned Social Security benefit who actually receive $100, $125, $150 a month.
Hmm.
That reduced Social Security, because the penalty becomes greater and greater every year, has the effect of basically saying all of your Social Security will be needed to pay Medicare Part B premiums. So it becomes harder and harder for Social Security recipients to pay for Medicare Part B, and that puts greater and greater pressure on their retirement.
So what are you seeing happening out there with individuals?
We are seeing individuals not being able to have that level, and they're going back to work. More and more retired educators are going back to work, either in schools or in other activities. There are teachers. I was talking to a lady yesterday who is from the San Mateo area, who is 76 years old, who is continuing to teach, because as long as she doesn't draw her teacher's retirement system benefit, she continues to receive her husband's spousal Social Security. But the second she retires, she loses that Social Security benefit. Because it doesn't happen until you start drawing your government pension. So she is 76. She's very happy that she's in good health or to stop teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So you see more and more cases of that.
And so this bill in California was brought in by Senator Feinstein?
Senator Feinstein is the leadoff, S-206. Along with her, she has Senator Collins and Snow from Maine as co-sponsors, both Republicans. You know, Senator Feinstein is a Democrat. This is a bipartisan bill. On the House side, H.R. 82 has been brought forward by Representative Berman and Representative McKeon, one Democrat, one Republican. When the Republicans were the party, majority party in the House, Representative McKeon was the lead sponsor, and Mr. Berman was the co-sponsor. Now that the Democrats are in majority party in the House, Mr. Berman is the lead and Mr. McKeon is the co. As I say, this has been a bipartisan and continues to be a bipartisan issue, recognizing that these penalties are much more severe than they were originally intended.
And is there an effort to fix this somehow, to modify it?
Yes, we have, as California Retired Teachers, California Teachers Association, National Education Association, United Teachers Los Angeles, numerous different organizations have joined together in both local and national coalitions urging repeal. We had 351 co-sponsors on H.R. 82. We have 36 co-sponsors on S. 206. On the House, 351 is more than 75% of the House. So it is a very recognized problem that the House of Representatives and the members of the House of Representatives have recognized. We just have not been able to have a vote on the bill in order to have the issue brought forward with a real vote so it can start moving toward the president's action.
And last year it was President Bush was trying to privatize Social Security. How would that affect this, or how would that have affected?
On the president's proposal to privatize Social Security, that would have had a very negative effect on the proposal. In fact, the president's proposal, because it had such a drastic restructuring of Social Security, it made it difficult for us to raise these equity issues.
Mm-hmm.
Once the president's proposal was not going forward, it had the effect of blocking other actions trying to look at long-term Social Security restructuring. So it just politically, when his effort didn't go forward, that meant almost no other efforts could go forward because the administration had indicated what they wanted. And if it wasn't that, they wouldn't be supporting.
Hmm.
The analogy I would use is in California this year when the Speaker, Fabian Nunez, and Governor Schwarzenegger reached agreement on what they thought would be health care legislation, and that legislation failed in the Senate, it was very difficult to bring forward any other comprehensive health care bills. Fortunately, Senate Bill 840 did go forward as a comprehensive bill, but it was very difficult to have other comprehensive bills considered once the Speaker and Governor's bill failed passage in the Senate. So that was the same thing as with the president's proposal on Social Security. Once that failed, it was very difficult to have other proposals brought forward.
Hmm. David Walrath, how can people get involved? How can they learn more?
They should definitely check with the Social Security Administration to make sure that the information they're receiving is correct. And secondly, if they are affected by these offsets, let friends, family, neighbors know about how it will be affecting them, and definitely work with their representatives in Congress. Member of the House of Representatives, I believe Jackie Speier is primarily San Mateo, letting Representative Speier know the problems and difficulties they are having because of these penalties, and continue to work with Senator Feinstein and Senator Boxer.
Is there a website?
The California Retired Teachers Association has a website, and we do updates on this. Our website is calrta.org,
okay,
starting with www.
Okay.
The National Education Association, on their website, has information on this problem.
Okay.
And I believe they are nea.org.
www.calrta.org and nea.org. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Keep us abreast of how these things are moving. I think this is a really important thing. As you say, people are just not aware of it until it's too late.
Oh, my pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity.
We'll tell the people that we're living in these times.
That was David Walrath, legislative advocate for the Retired Teachers Association in California, describing H.R. 82 and S. 206. We'll continue this conversation with Bill Lambert, describing how the government pension offset penalties and the windfall elimination provision affect retirees and teachers in particular, and also how it's affecting teacher recruiting and retention.
It really has a huge impact. In a time where we are today, where we're recruiting most of the teachers that we're trying to recruit out of the high schools for various and sundry math programs and science programs, most of those people are not coming straight out of the university. A lot of them are coming from business, and I can point to a person. Her name is Peg Cagle, who teaches at Lawrence Middle School, and Peg was a an architect for 17 years. And the way I found Peg is that I was reading the Los Angeles Times, and she was selected by the President Bush as one of the 10 or 15 best math teachers in America. And when I called her up and I explained the Social Security problem, I thought she'd have a heart attack, because what she didn't know was that the 17 years that she put in as an architect, and now she's been a teacher for some 16 years, so when she retires, she's going to get her teacher's retirement. And then when she gets to be Social Security age, she's going to lose 90% or almost 100% of her earned Social Security benefits. And so instead of working a lifetime of about 30 or 35 years and retiring on her life work, she's going to retire on half of her life work. So what happens is, in California, and there are 14 states in the union in which this this happens, and as far as teachers are concerned, here's what we face in California, and particularly in Los Angeles, where we're really trying to find the best teachers in the world. If we were to find a teacher in New York State, for example, who wanted to come to California and teach, and that person is what we'll say is a wonderful teacher and wants to come and teach algebra or mathematics or history or even elementary, whatever it is, and that person's had 15 years of experience and comes to California, that person automatically loses that 15 years that she had or he had in New York State, because New York State is a Social Security state. But it came about in about 1982 or 83 when the federal government gave all the states in the union the opportunity of making Social Security mandatory for all public employees, city, county, state, federal. And 14 states had their own retirement systems and said no. And so the next year they passed two laws. One was the offset, one was the windfall. The offset says that if you're married to a teacher in California, I'm using California as an example. If you want, I can give you a list of the 14 states. But if you're married to a teacher in California, if a teacher is married to a Social Security earner in California, and the Social Security earner precedes the teacher in death, the teacher gets a survivor benefit. But when the teacher retires under the teacher's retirement system, the day that person retires, that person loses her Social Security benefit. So what happened is that 14 states in the union, Alaska, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Georgia, Illinois, Kentucky, Louisiana, Maine, Massachusetts, Missouri, Nevada, Ohio, Rhode Island, and Texas. All of those states said no. And so what happens to teachers in all of those states who come into teaching, if their spouses die before they do, they lose their spousal benefit when they retire as a teacher. If they've had any income, if they qualify for Social Security benefits, when they retire and they want their Social Security, basically they lose it. So here's the real push for us. Here's the real thing for people in California, where I live and in Los Angeles, and that is this. We cannot recruit mainly in the business world, because those people coming out of the business world are Social Security earners. So when we recruit somebody out of a plant and they want to, or out of a science laboratory or out of a university who wants to come and teach in California, and we tell them they're going to lose their benefits, they walk the other way.
Mm-hmm, of course.
We also can't recruit in 36 states in the union. And it's funny because I was in Washington, D.C. About 2 or 3 years ago, and the state, the U.S. Office of Education was having a huge meeting of the 50 states trying to urge people in the 50 states to get people in business to come teach in, to come and teach. And so I said to one of those persons there, because people, one of the problems we have is the public doesn't know about this, and a lot of the people who are affected don't know, because when you take a job, they don't tell you. And so I said to this person, I said, do you know about this offset and windfall? No. And I said, well, I'll explain it to your business people who were here, which he wasn't interested in doing, by the way. But this is a huge, huge problem for all of us. Not only that, but it really is unfair. Teachers, and you should know this because this is really, it's very important. Teachers who never earned, so I have a daughter. My daughter teaches in Los Angeles. She's taught for 15 years. It's the only job she's ever had. She's not entitled to Social Security because she never earned it. But if my son-in-law dies before my daughter dies, he's a Social Security earner. She gets the benefit until she retires, and then she loses.
Mm.
Now, if my daughter quit her job and worked for Macy's, she'd keep her Social Security benefit.
Mm.
So if you don't earn it, you're not entitled to it. And it is a huge, huge block. And one of the things, and I don't know if you're, is that we have two bills in Congress, and one by Howard Berman and one by Dianne Feinstein. The Berman bill has over 350 co-sponsors of the bill. Very difficult getting a hearing. You know, it's an expensive bill. It's an $82 billion bill over 10 years. But this is not a give. It's not a freebie. Somebody said, "Well, why should anybody get a freebie? These people earned it,"
mm-hmm.
And so it's huge. And in some cases, there was a teacher from Texas who there was a hearing on the Senate side about 3 years ago, and there was a teacher from Texas, you know, testifying and saying that she was 80 years old and she couldn't afford to leave. To retire, because if she retires, she lost her husband's Social Security benefits, and the retirement system in Texas evidently wasn't as good as his benefits. So, and we're not talking about people in the teaching world who are really huge earners.
Right.
You know, we're
exactly.
talking about people who are at the most in most states of these states that I just read out, including California. So they make $60,000 or $70,000 a year And if they get 2% per year for every year they teach of their highest. So if you're making $70,000 and you've had 25 years, you're gonna get $35,000 a year retirement benefit. And if you've earned Social Security, that's all you're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a horrible thing, and we're interested in the public being aware of all of this, because the public demands, and we agree with them. The public demands the best teachers in the world for kids in California. We want to get them out of the businesses. We want to get them out of the banks. We want to get them out of the schools and the laboratories. We want them to come into teaching. In career education, here's another one too. If you want to teach careers to students, you want to teach the building trades or the automobile business, and you have to go out then and go in and get people who are doing all of that now, who are working in the automobile mechanic business or the teaching or the whatever it is, and the computer business. You know, get somebody who's an ace and can teach you how to fix computers and run the computers and program the computers, and those people are Social Security earners. So to get them to come into teaching school, not only are they going to take less money if they come in, but they're also going to lose their Social Security.
And Bill, does this affect, say, junior college teachers?
It does affect junior college teachers. And let me tell you who else, because I recently was appointed as a commissioner in Los Angeles County. So, and I was down at one of our commission meetings, and I was talking to some of the staff there, and I was telling them about this bill, and all of a sudden I find out that in Los Angeles County, every county employee in Los Angeles County is also hit by this Social Security thing.
Hmm.
Also, my daughter is an urban planner for the city of Santa Monica, and she used to work for West Hollywood and small cities around the state.
Mm-hmm.
If are also hit by, if they're in a retirement system like PERS and they're not into Social Security, a lot of these small cities, and I think there's one other county up in near Sacramento, not Sacramento, but near, I'm trying to think, just south of San Francisco, there's a big county up there, Contra Costa.
Mm-hmm.
I think Contra Costa is another county that is hit by the Social Security. The postmen in America are hit by it.
So it's anyone with CalPERS?
CalPERS?
The PERS that you just mentioned.
Yeah, well, if they're only in CalPERS and they're not in Social Security, then they are also subject to the offset and the windfall.
Yeah.
So it's like the L.A. County employees. I mean, you know, the Los Angeles County employees. They're all hit by this. I had a teacher in my office, a person. It wasn't a teacher. She was about 52 years old, and she had worked her life as an artist, and she wanted to come and teach art in L.A. Unified Schools. And somebody told her I could help her get a job. And she was about 52, and I said, well, you know, you're kind of old. Well, listen, she said, I'm going to work for 20 years. And when I described the offset and the windfall to her, she blew out the door before I could even say goodbye.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. And the thing to me is that these people have, all of the years they put into Social Security, the employer put 7-point-some-odd percent into their retirement, and the student or the teacher himself or herself. So the 14.5 or 15% of their wages, you know, of the money of this company, went into the Social Security system. And now they don't get it. So it's unfair, and it hurts. And it hurts us in a way that, people can't calculate. But when you want the best in the schools, when you want the best teachers, when you want the best administrators, when you want the best of everything for the kids in our school system, and we have to tell people what happened, they run the other way.
What about the young people that are going into teacher training? When do they learn about this?
If they're lucky, they learn about it when they go get a job. But I will tell you this: if you walk into a public school now and talk to a teacher and say, "Do you know about this?" Maybe they know about it, and maybe they don't. But an awful lot of them find out the day they retire, and that's horrible.
And so how long has this been going on? You said since the early 80s?
Yes, I've had a bill in Congress with Buck McKeon. For the last 6 years, Buck McKeon, you know, when the Republicans had the majority in Congress, Congressman McKeon from Santa Clarita, very, very nice man, he and I talked about it, and he put a bill in for me. And Howard Berman, Congressman Berman, became the principal co-author of, it was the McKeon-Berman bill. And that was 6 years ago. And Senator Feinstein has had a bill there for 6 years. And the problem is we've never been able to generate a hearing. Even with, Congress only has 435 members. And when you have 351 co-sponsors on the bill, that's more than you need, right? So we're hopeful, and I'm so happy that you're interested in this, and hopefully your listeners are interested in this. And they need to call Dianne Feinstein and urge her to get a hearing. She's been wonderful on this bill, and so is Howard Berman and Buck McKeon. And we think that when the public finds out about this and people begin to understand it, because, there's some military. My wife has a friend who works in Washington, D.C. for the Department of the Navy, and she's stuck on this thing. So
again, it's down to the states of depending on which state you're in, whether you're affected, if you're in the military.
People in 50 states are affected.
Uh-huh.
Teachers in the states I read out are only teachers.
Uh-huh.
But they're affected. Fire and police in a lot of the 50 states are affected. are affected. Postal workers in the 50 states are affected.
Military?
Some military could be affected. You know, so you have to. You really got to go. My daughter is trying now to find out in Los Angeles County how many. You know, Los Angeles County is made up of a multiple of cities, right? Just like every place else is. So you're where now in California? Where?
In Alameda, so the San Francisco Bay Area.
Okay, so is Alameda affected by this? I don't know. There are people in the city who work for the city of Los Angeles who are affected by this. The sheriffs, for example, they're L.A. County. Every sheriff in L.A. County is affected by this. So it's a huge thing.
It's a huge thing, and it's really under the radar.
It's under the radar, and that's why I'm so excited about maybe you can get it out of the radar, because the public really needs to know. And, you know, we have a huge number of people. Most of the Democratic congressmen in California and about half the Republicans have signed on to the bill. And the question is, how do we get it out from under the covers and into the limelight?
Well, Bill, I'm going to extend the same invitation to you that I extended to David Walrath, and that is to please stay in touch with us on this, because we do want to continue to bring this to the public. It's very important that they know as soon as they can.
Yeah. But you know, if you came to work for LA Unified and decided you were going to teach radio broadcasting, for example, and you worked for the next 15 years in LA Unified, and you retired. If you're a married person and your husband preceded you in death, you'd lose his benefit,
mm-hmm.
and you'd lose a huge number of the years that you worked in the radio business.
So who does it actually benefit in the long run?
Well, I think they did this bill way back when somebody thought too many people were getting. Too many retirements, right?
Uh-huh.
And which I don't know if that was true or not at the time, but you know, so, and somebody decided, well, we're going to cut down on these public retirements. Well, nobody knew about it. I mean, look, I was lobbyist for the teachers union for some 40 years, and I only found out about this thing 6 years ago.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's been hidden.
Yeah.
And it really deserves to be put out. The public, if the public is listening and they know a legislator, a congressperson, they ought to write to their congressperson and say, we need a hearing, we need this bill to go to the president, and we need it signed, because we need to treat teachers and people fairly, you know, because the only people who are involved are people who go into public service, okay, and they're not people who are in the business world. So, everybody loves teachers like me. I mean, I was a teacher, and the world loves them. And all of a sudden, when you find out that the people that you depend on to teach your child and to bring the best to them, you know, as those people reach retirement, they're going to lose a huge portion of their earned retirement money they and their employer put into the Social Security system. They're not getting anything for anything. In fact, you can look at it the other way and say, all of us who are teachers and public employees who are stiffed by this, we're paying the bill for the government, you know, because
yeah.
they're taking our money, right, that we're not getting, and they're paying out Social Security benefits.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
That's
okay.
My story.
Raising Sand will update our listeners on this issue as new information becomes available. In the meantime, if you know teachers, firefighters, police officers, even some military personnel and postal workers who might be affected, urge them to learn more or to get in touch with the Social Security Administration to see if they are affected.
Tell the people that we're living in these times.
In March 2000, then-President Bill Clinton called the Indian subcontinent the most dangerous place in the world. Today, the Bush administration is pushing ahead with a controversial nuclear deal with India that could make the most dangerous place in the world even more dangerous. The latest saga in the story of the deal occurred on September 6, when a nuclear suppliers group, the NSG, which sets widely observed export controls on nuclear technology, approved a U.S.-India proposal to lift a ban on nuclear trade with India. The next stop is the U.S. Congress, which has to approve the deal before the United States can actually engage in nuclear commerce with India. Andrew Lichterman is a lawyer and policy analyst for the Oakland, California-based Western States Legal Foundation.
One of the reasons that President Bill Clinton called this region the most dangerous place in the world is because we have India and Pakistan, both of them armed with nuclear weapons, facing each other across a border that has been the site of nearly continuous skirmishing between the two countries for many years. And what you really have is a developing slow-motion nuclear arms race between the two countries in the context of threats and actual warfare, for example, the 1999 fighting over Kargil. And what we're seeing here is a deal between the United States and India that would allow India to expand its nuclear trade and to obtain nuclear fuels for its nuclear reactors and other kinds of nuclear technology on international markets. And the last step that's just been completed is this deal was approved by consensus by the nuclear suppliers group. And there's a certain irony in this, since the nuclear suppliers group was formed shortly after India tested a nuclear weapon in 1974. And what the nuclear suppliers group does is it sets voluntary but widely observed controls on the export of nuclear technology. And because India had developed and tested a nuclear weapon, in part using technology that had been imported from other countries, supposedly for civilian purposes, this group of nuclear technology exporters was formed to prevent this, if possible, from happening in the future. And it's also important to note in this regard that India was not at that time and still is not a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which includes the five original nuclear weapon states. And there are three nuclear weapon states, potentially four if you really consider North Korea a full-fledged nuclear weapon state, outside the ambit of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And these are India, Pakistan, Israel, and again, North Korea. And so what this deal was intended to do was to give India access to the capacity for nuclear trade that it really hadn't had since 1974. And one of the important aspects of this is that it will allow India to more easily expand its nuclear arsenal. India has a shortage of domestic uranium, and it will then be able to use imported nuclear fuel, uranium fuel, for its civilian nuclear sector and to devote its relatively scarce domestic uranium to nuclear weapons production.
And where is it going to be buying the uranium?
Well, we'll be able to buy it on the international market from whoever wishes to supply it.
Okay. But New Delhi is saying that it just wants this, the cooperation of the United States is aimed solely at expanding energy production.
Well, you know, of course, that's what they're going to say. And they have to say that in order to be able to complete the deal, because there was a great deal of concern, both in the nuclear suppliers group and also, to a degree, in the U.S. Congress, that this deal would allow India to more easily expand its nuclear arsenal. And one of the particular aspects of it that was contended over throughout its course through the enabling legislation that went through Congress in 2006 and then again in the nuclear suppliers group is what will happen if India once again tests a nuclear weapon. Will this automatically result in the termination of the nuclear trade? And there are varying interpretations of what's likely to happen, because the prior U.S. legislation does make it appear that a test by India would lead to termination of nuclear trade. But on the other hand, the agreement that was made between the U.S. and India is silent on the matter, and the nuclear suppliers group document is fairly vague. So, you know, as is so often the case, the way that this is going forward is by papering over some of the more difficult issues with vague language. And now, as this comes back to Congress in this short session in September, we may well see the Bush administration take a very similar tack and try to paper over the ambiguities in the process with some kind of a fairly spare formulation approving the deal.
Now, it's likely, though, that Pakistan is going to not appreciate this deal, especially in light of what happened in Pakistan with the United States in the last week.
Well, they're not going to appreciate it, and the chances are that, you know, if there is indeed any acceleration of the Indian nuclear program as a result of the possibilities for expanded use of domestic uranium that are made possible by this deal, that Pakistan will respond in kind, accelerating the arms race in the region.
Mm-hmm. And, Andrew, how is this different to what Iran is saying they want nuclear power for?
Well, you know, it's an interesting comparison, and this is one of the other ways, of course, in which many people in the arms control field are concerned that this deal will erode the global nonproliferation regime. The nuclear nonproliferation treaty basically was a deal that had two reciprocal obligations. The non-nuclear weapon states agreed that they would not develop nuclear weapons in exchange for access to civilian uses of nuclear technology. The five original nuclear weapon states agreed that they would negotiate in good faith for the elimination of their nuclear arsenals. And we should recall that the United States entered into this treaty over three decades ago now and has shown little sign of negotiating in good faith for the elimination of its nuclear arsenal. And so one of the really disturbing aspects of this deal is what you're really seeing is a mutual reaffirmation of the legitimacy of nuclear arsenals by the United States, which has a disarmament obligation under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty that it's been largely ignoring, and India's nuclear arsenal that was developed entirely outside the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. And so the message is, you know, if you develop a nuclear arsenal outside the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and it serves the interests of the superpowers armed with nuclear weapons, you will be brought into the nuclear club with very little penalty.
Mm-hmm. And if, like Iran, you are not part of that, you're going to be threatened.
Absolutely. So it just reinforces this two-tier world.
Uh-huh. That was Andrew Lichterman, a lawyer and policy analyst for the Oakland, California-based Western States Legal Foundation, who will be with us again early in October for an in-depth look at what underlies this U.S.-India deal. In an article titled "Rushing into the Wrong Future, the U.S.-India Nuclear Deal, Energy and Security," Lichterman writes, "Originally announced in July 2005 by President George Bush and Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, the nuclear deal is part of a broader set of agreements centering on increased U.S.-India military cooperation and high-tech trade. In the United States, an array of corporate interests led by the nuclear industry and arms makers are supporting the deal. They see the possibility not only for nuclear trade but for big-ticket weapon sales as well as selling other goods and services to India's elite. Only a small fraction of the population, but a huge new market nonetheless. This emerging economic order, which systematically generates huge disparities of wealth both within and among nations, is itself a source of conflict. The answer envisioned by the military elites is to throw ever more sophisticated levels of high-tech violence at these conflicts. Foreign policy pundits and officials in both countries extol the benefits of increased military cooperation, with the more enthusiastic on the U.S. side envisioning India as a junior partner for the U.S. military agenda in Asia. In the aftermath of wars against Afghanistan and Iraq, the prospect of U.S. military action in Asia is hardly remote. I'll put a link to this article on the Raising Sand website, www.raisingsandradio.org. Then, as I say, we'll do an in-depth interview with Lichterman in early October. And that is our show for today. Thanks for listening to Raising Sand Radio on KZSU Stanford. And as always, if you want to listen to any of our other archive shows, visit our website, www.raisingsandradio.org. You're also invited to send me an email at susan@raisingsandradio.org and let us know what else you would like to hear in the future. Let's go out with Dave Rovics and Who Will Tell the People.
For Fanta, a death threat every week, and sometimes life is short when the truth is too dangerous for someone to report. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? The cancer rates are skyrocketing, though people are smoking less. If you live near a nuke, your life is bound to be a mess. Clean water's almost gone all over the earth, and what's left they want to privatize and see how much it's worth. Chevron is gunning down the students of Nigeria, turning the land to waste while the babies die of diphtheria. And the temperatures are rising, the world's forests are on fire. Pretty soon Brazil will be one raging funeral pyre. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times?
All views expressed on Raising Sand are that of the hosts and guests, not of KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of Raising Sand on KZSU Stanford.
And while they're there, they're working hard, building parts for cars. The Army's running torture schools to keep the earth under control, and they're relocating Navajos so they can mine some extra coal. Our taxes pay McDonald's to sell tumors in Shanghai, while 100,000 poison vets are just about to die. And who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? And the people are resisting wherever you may go, and this is the single biggest fact they don't want you to know. From New Delhi to New Mexico, there are battles going on, and the darkest hour is just before the dawn. In Berkeley and New York, they're raiding radio stations, trying to turn the voice of the people into the voice of the corporations. Will we seize the airwaves, wipe the sweat off of our brow, stand and face the beast and shout democracy now? Who will tell the people that free speech is a ruse? The corporations run the country, and then they make the news. Is it media or mind control, heroic victories or crimes? Who will tell the people that we're living in these times? That we're living in these times?